You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Go Wild. Go Wild is the fastest growing social media platform for outdoor enthusiasts. If you love to hunt, fish, camp, hike, this is the community for you. Go to the Google Play Store or wherever you download your apps and download the Go Wild app and get started today. And for more information, you can visit timetogowild.com. Let's get outside. It's time to go wild.
Welcome to the For Love of the Land podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith
and Matt Dye.
Each week, we're interviewing guests from across America. They all have one thing in common. They all are tied to the land. So if you're like us and you love all things land, welcome home. All right, guys. This is Adam with another For Love of the Land podcast. I am here at one of my favorite places in the world, and I'm sitting down, and we're going to talk some old school agriculture and talk about some of the stuff that occurred over the past whenever. I've got my grandpa here who worked with MFA, Missouri Farmers Association, correct? From when did you start?
52 to 92.
52 to 92. So, long time with MFA.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you saw some changes occur over those years.
A lot of changes.
What was the, when you started in 52, what were you doing?
Working at the warehouse, handling 100 pounds of feed.
So basically, at that point, how did the feed come to the warehouse?
In a boxcar.
In a boxcar. Came on the railroad.
Yeah.
And you unloaded it and then put it in the trucks or wherever.
Yeah. Put it in the warehouse, load out trucks from the warehouse.
So back in those days, 52, and when you say feed, we're talking kind of the molasses, sweet feed type stuff.
Yeah.
Mix of corn and other things, right? Oh, what was a price per bag back in then? Back then?
Oh, probably $3 maybe. I'm not sure.
Long time ago. Yeah. What was it? So 1952, how much were people really feeding hay? Like, what kind of hay equipment was there? Were people really cutting a lot of hay?
In 52, we had that terrible drought.
Yep.
52 and 3. And we imported hay from everywhere. We had people out buying hay in Kansas and, well, even as far away as Canada.
Okay.
And they'd bring it in. We had cars backed up everywhere with hay in them.
Mm.
Farmers come in, pickups and everything.
Was there hay, at that point, was there hay bales or was it hay stacks?
They baled in.
Okay, they did bale it.
Yeah.
Round or square? Square.
Square. All okay. They is a few small rounds, but
yeah,
it wasn't rounds like now.
Yeah, not the 5x6s or 6x6s yeah. that we have now, especially not wrapped.
No.
Yeah. How many people actually cut and baled into square bales back then?
I know of one.
Okay, most of it was just cut it and rake it into piles and then haul it to the barn. Yeah.
I had to rake some and had a neighbor had a baler, had some baled, but most of it we either stacked or put loose in a barn loft.
Gotcha. Wow. That's interesting. What was, so 1952, then going into the 60s, what were some of the herbicide use? What was herbicide use like? Many people using that?
Not too much then.
Gotcha. More of the 70s? Or when did you start seeing herbicide get used more?
Oh, probably in the 60s probably it started.
Gotcha. One of the things that always shocks me the most is when you talk about the herbicide 456D. What was that?
245T.
245T.
Yeah, This was the one they used in Vietnam to defoliate those jungles.
Basically, Agent Orange.
Yeah.
Yeah, and people were using it as a brush killer around here.
Yeah.
Mm.
And they outlawed it. I had a lot in the basement when they stopped sale on it.
Gotcha. That's crazy.
Yeah.
245T.
Yeah, it was a good brush killer.
I imagine it was. It was proven. Yeah, but it just wasn't so good for the environment and the people around it. Wow.
We didn't realize that at the time.
Mm, yeah, There wasn't enough research on it and long-term effects.
No.
Huh. What did fertilizing? What was that like back then?
Triple eight.
And
the bag, usually triple eight.
Yeah.
Of course, we had bulk trucks that and a fertilizer plant where we could mix whatever they wanted.
Mm. Yeah. And you had a fertilizer plant right there.
Spreader, yeah.
Yeah. How many people actually put fertilizer or lime on their pastures?
Lime then, a lot of people put it on.
Did they?
And as we progressed, as more and more people used fertilizer on their pastures and in their hay fields.
Gotcha.
In 52, there wasn't too many using it then.
Yeah. In 52, there were still a lot of just native grass pastures.
Yeah.
It wasn't a whole lot of fescue.
No.
Yeah. So orchard grass, fescue, these cool seasons, they came in, I think, in late 50s, early 60s.
Somewhere along there, yeah.
Yeah. And then that started changing. Did MFA carry that seed?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We carried all kind of seed.
Gotcha. Huh. Did you ever carry, like, native grass seed?
No.
No, because at that point, I mean, we still don't have a great grasp on harvesting, and there's not great vast quantities of native grass seed just because it's a little different than fescue. So, that's interesting. What's been some of the biggest changes for you? And there's even been drastic changes from 92 to 2019, but what have been some of the biggest changes when from 52 to 92 that you saw?
52. Well, we went from all sack feed to all bulk feed. And we went from hauling 1,000 pounds of feed out in the bag to where we was up to 12 ton in a bulk when we went to a farm.
Wow. And was that loose or in bag? Yeah, just loose feed, yeah. They put it in a silo or whatever they had there.
In a barn loft, usually.
Okay.
Or they'd feed direct over the cattle in the grade A barn.
Okay. Yeah. I've been in several barns in the last 3 months where you'll go into the barn and you can tell, like, there's still old tools and stuff on the barn or in like, the workroom where you're like, that's been there for 40 years.
Yeah.
And one of the barns actually was in southern Iowa, and you could see where big truck would pull in, and there was this big old chute, and that's where they'd put the feed or whatever, and the chute fed it down into this big trough, and then inside this trough was the grinder, the corkscrew, whatever you call that, and that
auger.
The auger, there you go. There you go, perfect. The auger. Which would then feed it out. All the whole side of this barn was just, it had these little drops where it'd go down into the trays. Slanted floors, concrete floors, and how many barns do you see set up like that now?
You know, there isn't many dairy barns left in this area now.
No.
When I retired, dairying was a big deal around here.
Yeah. And
right now, there isn't many dairies.
No. I think in 92 or in the 90s, Wright County, which is where your MFA store was, they were like number one or number two in the state for dairies.
Probably.
So, very, very popular, and there's not many around here anymore.
Most of them that I was dealing with are out of business completely.
Yeah. It's sad. I think going back to that barn in Iowa, it was hogs. That's what that one was set up for. And you can see it had wood posts set up, kind of holding, you know, wood structure. But each post down in the bottom two foot was just wore down where them hogs were rubbing those posts.
Yeah.
Just pretty incredible. And it was one of those barns that, it would have been quite the infrastructure back in the 70s and 80s, but now it's just sitting vacant for years and years, and it's kind of sad.
This is another thing we went through a period of feeder pigs.
Yeah.
you know, where that feeder pig barn is still up there.
Yep.
And it's pigs, feeder pigs come in from everywhere.
Mm. Oh, yeah, feeder pig barn, Mansfield, yeah. Missouri. Yeah, mm-hmm. Feeder pigs. And were they, those feeder pigs, most of them are put in barns and side lots? Or were they kind of, they weren't out in pastures doing anything?
They
kind
brought,
of,
yeah, they were raised in lots.
Okay.
Pastures.
Yeah.
And they gathered them in that barn,
yeah,
and sold them by auction to,
okay,
to feeders all over.
Similar to a sale barn for cows.
Yeah,
here
it was
now.
A sale barn, other than they sold them over the telephone to people maybe in Iowa or wherever.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Because they had graded these pigs, and they had certain grades, and they had graded on a telephone. They'd tell them a grade on a telephone. And this grade had to stack up, of course, when the buyer got them shipped to them.
That's crazy.
But they would be trucks backed up to the top of that hill with feeder pigs on feeder pig day down there.
Wow. And they'd ship them anywhere in the country, basically, where,
yeah,
the buyers were.
Yeah.
Wow. How were cows sold back in the 50s and 60s? Still sale barn, or how did they? I can't imagine they were sold the same way.
The what? Oh, the cows.
Yeah.
No, they sold on site.
Okay.
They'd run them into a sale barn where they could see them.
Okay.
Either by head or feeder cow or feeder stock a lot of times by weight.
Yeah. Yeah.
But dairy cattle will be sold by head.
Mm. That's crazy. What about, so with MFA, back in those days, explain to me how that store was owned. Because I think there was a difference in why it's owned now.
Oh, yeah, it was farmer owned when I was managing it. Why? It was farm owned when I sold out to the
corporate
company.
Yeah.
When I sold out to the MFA corporate in North Missouri, why we had, when we sold to these farmers, whatever our profits were at the end of the year was divided into dividends to each farmer.
Okay.
And, of course, we had a retained saving.
Yeah.
We'd send out so much by letter, by check, and then the rest by retained saving. And when I sold out to MFA, we retired all the retained savings that I put out to farmers.
Mm.
And some of it is a pretty good check.
I bet. So it truly was kind of like just a co-op where everybody had,
yeah,
money in the pot, and then however much that company made, then it got spit out.
According to the
profits.
Volume of business that they did with you.
That's interesting. Huh. You don't see many farmers' operations running like that anymore, I don't think.
No.
I can't imagine.
No, this one down here at Ava, I've run it too for quite a while.
Yeah.
And it's an entirely different looking place now.
Yeah. And actually, the MFA in Mansfield, the one you ran for years and years, is no longer.
Yeah, they closed
it. Shut
it
down in early 2000s.
Yeah.
Pretty sad.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting whenever you look at the way it operated right next to the railroad. Bring the feed in on the truck, could just load it off or take it off the railroad.
Load it on truck.
Load it on a truck.
Well, we had the mill down there. We'd bring our corn in on rail, and our pellets in rail, and we'd grind the corn there and had molasses and stuff we'd mix right there.
Yeah.
On the scales.
Yeah. Hmm. And, you know, one thing about the MFA as a kid, because I was born in 87, so the first 5 years of my life, you said till 94, though, right?
92.
So the first 5 years of my life, you were still running it.
Oh, yeah. I got pictures of you running around in there when I retired.
Still to this day.
Yeah.
If I go in a feed store and I smell that, it takes me right back. Because,
yeah,
there's a very distinct smell with those MFAs or,
yeah,
any kind of feed store. So, Was there anybody doing, when they were planting corn and crops around here, was there much of that?
Oh, quite a bit. Daryl was out on, Daryl Sparling had a big cornfield out there. And
compare that to today. Do you think you saw more corn in 92 than 2019?
Oh, yeah, I think so.
There was more corn back then?
Yeah, I think so.
Just because most people were trying to fatten cows on silage and
a lot of them planted it for silage.
Yeah, and so probably a lot more corn, and now probably not in the major fields or huge fields of corn, but there were still like 15-acre patches or 10-acre patches of corn. Huh. What about Milo?
They used it for silage.
Okay, so I'm asking these questions because our listeners come from all over the U.S., and it may seem like, oh, why are you asking about corn or Milo? Because everybody's been planting that around here for years and years. We're in an area where there's not many crops now, mostly pastures.
We weren't really a crop back then.
No, but people still planted it for feeding cows.
Yeah, but, as far as thrashing, like it did with Milo, no one raised it.
No one
for
really
grain. Raised
it. Yeah, yeah. They just chopped it for silage. Yeah, I can remember quail hunting a couple of Milo fields north of Mansfield. You remember that?
Yeah.
Yep. Out by, what was that lake? Cook Lake, yeah. I think. Lake Cook or something like that. Quail hunted the old Milo fields. Was there any no-till drilling? Do you remember the first time you ever saw a no-till drill?
I don't think I've even saw one yet.
Yeah. You've been out of the game since 92. There's a few of them around now. But and I asked that because I didn't figure you ever got in on the no-till drill chance. Mm-hmm. Back in 92, people were still plowing and disking harrowing, and that was how you planted the crops.
Yep.
And so definitely come from the background of that was the way you had to do it. And now with no-till drills and corn planters, people are going away from that, and there's no tillage, which is we're finding is drastically helping the soil quality and water quality and erosion problems.
But and we wouldn't have believed you could have done it.
No, you wouldn't have. And that's where we're still trying to fight that fight. There's no way you can do that. Yeah, for sure. And
we thought we had to have a good seed bed.
That's right. Yep, a good seed bed. So did you guys sell equipment through MFA?
Not tractors or anything. We sold repairs for mowing machines and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah, wow. Going to that, there'd be a lot of people, I'm sure, even today, that aren't on the no-till drill, corn planter, seed planter bandwagon, but more and more people are doing. I can only imagine, 92, if you came into Wright County MFA and said, here, this is how you're going to plant your fields. I can't imagine it would have gone over like a lead balloon.
No, I don't know when I first heard of the no-till.
Really? That's interesting. Huh. Anything else that you can really think of? Big transitions, big changes happen in the ag world from 52 to 92?
Oh, I'm sure if I
really
sit
think about
fitting.
It. Yeah. Of course, I kind of put you on the hot seat because I didn't even tell you we were doing this. I just started pulling out the gear and I put a headset on you. So let's talk ag.
I didn't even know that I've been out of the farm business for 26 years. I've been retired.
Yeah.
So there's been a lot of changes since I've retired.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. All right, so kind of transitioning out of the ag, I have the United Farm Agency 1928 Spring Catalog. So United Farm Agency was real estate. It's actually called United Country now, which is a brokerage that Matt and I work for. But this one was the very first real estate listing catalog that they printed in the spring of 1928. How old were you in 1928?
Four.
4 years old. So we're going way back. And so there's some listings here that are just like, whoa, to give you an idea and the listeners an idea how much has changed. We're going to three Mansfield listings, and I'm going to read these to you. And I'll read it exactly the way it's written. It's kind of it's interesting. It's a little bit different in the way we talk now, the way we write. So we have a 200-acre lot for $6,000. Milk cow, team, wagon, harness, and farm tools with money-making dairy and stock farm. Beautiful home and producer. Well improved on County Road. Only 9 miles over, same to Mansfield for all advantages. High school, railroad, cheese factory, etc. 3 miles Gasconade River. Fine fishing. Mail and telephone service. 200 acres tillable. 185 in high state of cultivation. Fertile dark loam soil for all crops. Corn, wheat, oats, hay, soybeans. Balanced, in wire fenced. Pond watered, woodland pasture. Wood for home use, mostly in tame grass now. 70 acres under woven wire fence. Good orchard. 75 apple, 30 peach, also pear, plum and cherry trees, grapes. Owner's income last year over $2,300. Good two-story, seven-room frame house, painted white. Concrete foundation. Two porches, beautiful view to the south, fine lawn. Beautiful shade trees, well water, 40-foot barn, two poultry houses, smokehouse, machine shed. Owner has prospered and is retiring. You should do the same here. Only $6,000. Part cash, terms of the balance in early possession. Worth your immediate inspection. This and other selected bargains here shown by C.A. Stevens, Mansfield, Wright County, Missouri. Does that sound pretty familiar to what you remember about?
I don't remember a listing, really.
You don't ever remember back in the when you were a kid, people listing the farm and showing?
No.
So this one, that makeup, you've got a farm that's got cultivation, it's got pasture, it's got peach trees and fruit trees, it's got well water, a smokehouse, machine shop. Does that sound a lot like farms back in those days? 200 acres and made $2,300 one year.
Yeah, that's a good income.
That was a good income in 1928?
Yeah.
Wow. So kind of tell me, soybeans, all the crops listed in this were most likely not leaving the farm. They were mainly meant to grow and feed the cows there on that farm.
Yeah.
There wasn't like a cut the soybeans and then they're going somewhere down the road and they're going to end up getting shipped to China or whatever. No. Just plant them here to feed your cows. When it says, and part of that it said, what it say? It said wild, tame grass now. What do you think that meant?
I don't, red top, maybe.
Switching over to something not
red
so.
Red top and orchard grass, maybe.
Okay.
Fescue come in.
This was 28, so still years from fescue.
They wasn't a whole lot of tame grass then.
Yeah, and when they said tame, basically they were meaning a non-native kind of a cool season coming in, right?
Yeah.
Probably. I would assume so, based on, because everybody always called wild grass, or they called native grasses wild grass,
yeah,
right?
That's mostly pasture.
Yeah. And so that's what I'm assuming. When it said woodland pasture, I'm guessing a mix of trees and grass.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of the woodland setting that was so prosperous to the quail.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just blown away reading this. I'll read another one to you. What about the cherry trees, fruit trees? Pretty much every little farm in the Midwest, or it seemed like, have some of those fruit trees.
Oh, some of them.
Yeah. Here's another one. This is one you'll like. This is right up my alley for budget. 160 acres, $800. Two sets improvements, only $500 cash. An opportunity for someone to own a good farm on small investment. Close to schools and church, 4 miles of village, store, few minutes run to all advantages of Mansfield, railroad, high school, cheese factory, good markets, all products, wood, etc. 80 acres of good tillable land, 40 acres in cultivation, balanced and fenced, spring watered, woodland pasture, estimated 5,000 cords wood and 100,000 feet saw timber, 2 miles to the mill, some apple and peach trees, 2 log cabins, oak shaded, spring water, fine view, river in sight, 2 small barns, hen house and smokehouse, owner too old to handle any longer, makes quick sale price $800 or $500 cash. Terms on balance to suit and immediate possession. This and other selected bargains here shown by C.L. Lewis or C.A. Stevens, Mansfield, Wright County, Missouri. What do you think about that?
That's a good buy, wasn't it?
It was a real good buy. Don't you wish you would have bought all that back in the day?
Yeah, but no one had any money.
That's why it was $800 sounds pretty cheap, but nobody had. You were working for how much a day?
Oh, back then, when I was a kid, I was in grade school. I was working 50 cents a day.
So it took a lot of days to pay for an $800 farm. Yeah. That's incredible. I got one more for you in Mansfield. This is 120 acres for $3,900. County Road Farm, 5 acres of grapes. A farm that will appeal to you, on which you can make money. Land is all fenced and in neighborhood of high-class farms. On County Road, only 6 miles. All advantages, good railroad, high school, 7 miles, cheese factory, 2 miles, Gasconade River, fine fishing. Hunting for small game, mail, and telephone. 120 acres tillable, 60 acres now in cultivation. Fertile, dark loam soil, corn, hay, oats, land lays well. Balance of good pasture and fine timber. Wire fence, spring fed, 5 acres bearing 6-year-old grapes. Also good family orchard, apple, pear, cherry, and peach trees. Good 4-room frame house, painted white, stone foundation. 2 porches, fruit tree shade, well at door, barn, poultry house, smokehouse, and well house. A real buy at $3,900. Only $1,000 cash needed. Terms on balance to suit possession arranged. Your work here will mean success.
That was high price compared to them others, wasn't it?
120 acres for $3,900. You know what I find interesting about that? I kind of have a pretty good idea where that farm's at. On the Gasconade River, talks about fine fishing. You'd be a, if you tried to make it to go fishing on that part of the river in this day and age, you'd have to do some hunting for some good fishing.
Yeah.
There's not that many fish in that part of the creek anymore.
No, all these creeks used to have good fishing.
Yeah.
Bryant Creek down here had good fishing.
And now it's filled in with gravel and there's not any deep holes anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of frightening to see the change that's happened from 1928 to now. Yeah. Good fishing in a part of the creek that if I was fishing there now, I'd be a starving man because there's just not much there. Yeah, I don't know. I think, painted white. That was another thing that kind of caught my eye. 2 listings talked about the houses being painted white.
Yeah.
Was that just popular back then?
Probably not a lot of houses were painted.
Okay. Not a lot of houses were painted, but if they're painted white, they were a better house.
Oh, yeah.
And white, was white paint pretty cheap?
I expect.
I would assume so. I think old whitewash paint.
Everything was pretty cheap.
Yeah. Even these farms, but you weren't, so were the people, the employers. Apparently, they were pretty cheap, too, paying you 50 cents a day. When you signed on with MFA, so you were working as a kid for 50 cents a day. When you signed on with MFA, that was post-World War II.
That was about 75 cents an hour.
75 cents an hour.
Yeah.
Wow. So you're making big bucks compared to before the war, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Huh. I remember the first job I ever had, I was making $6 and no, take that back. $5.25 an hour. Now they're trying to get $14 an hour on minimum wage or whatever it ends up being. It's interesting to me to see all the changes that have occurred in these 3 listings. Fruit trees, every one of them has fruit trees. Every one of them has cultivated land. Every one of them talks about the actual fences. Every one of them has or talks about a river or a creek. So that was highly important. At this point, well water was still drawn up from outside. There was no indoor plumbing.
Yeah, a lot of people use springs.
Yeah, to get their water.
There was no indoor plumbing come in the 50s when electricity come through the country.
Yeah, man. Tell me the story, since we're talking ag, but before we started recording this, you got to tell me the story since we're on water. World War II, you said you were dying of thirst. Remember the story you told me? Yeah, tell me that again.
Oh, we just crossed a river and took a bridge.
Was that crossing the river out of France and into Germany, or were you in Germany?
No, we were inside Germany.
Okay.
And I was thirsty. And I knew someone told me there was a pump down by the river. That was where the bridge was. We were about three blocks from it, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, I found an old dishpan, and I went down there and got that water and carried it back up through there. I didn't know what was between me and that water, but I wanted water bad.
So you didn't have any canteens with water?
Had canteens, but then I had a canteen. Hold a quart of water, but I didn't have any water in it.
Gotcha. Were you drinking, like, if you ran across the pond or anything, were you trying to drink out of that, or did...
I would have drank about anything, but we had little pills, halazone pills we could put in, supposedly to purify anything.
Gotcha. But supposedly.
We didn't worry about that. We didn't run into anything much.
Really?
All the plumbing and everything in the towns were shot out. There wasn't any water in them.
Mm.
Just old shot out houses and bombed out houses.
There's no water in there.
No.
Most of the wells or whatever that was in town was probably bombed out too.
Oh, it was all bombed out there. The only thing I found to drink was in a cellar was a bunch of canned cherries. I drank the juice off. Drank the juice off of them.
Oh, I can't even imagine. The reason we brought this up was, I don't even remember how we got on that, but we were talking about how I don't really, Grandma and I were saying, how we don't really like drinking water.
When you don't have water, there's nothing that's precious.
Mm. How far was it? You said about three blocks.
Yeah.
And you told me something. You said when you went down, of course, you could carry your gun in your hand, so if somebody did jump out, you could have the gun out. But then on the way back, you had to carry it out over your sling.
Yeah, you had to sling it over your shoulder because you couldn't carry a dishpan in both hands and a rifle.
Oh. So if you ran into a German at that point, you said you were just going to say, just shoot me because I want my water.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thrown that water on him.
Oh, that's crazy. And that was right there just before the Battle of the Bulge?
Yeah, that's before the Battle of the Bulge.
So you were, wow.
That was in the Siegfried Line, Germans defensive.
Gotcha.
They had this defensive line that was supposed to stop everybody.
Mm.
It did hold us up a long time.
Yeah. But you got through it. Hmm. Well, that pretty well wraps us up. You got anything else? Any comments?
No comments.
All right. I know I threw you on the hot seat, and we've got a couple more listings we're going to go through today. So hopefully you guys enjoyed it. I know weren't planning on talking old war stories, but at some point we may have to bring you back just to talk all those old war stories, because I know a lot of people enjoy hearing them. So anyway, hopefully you guys liked it, and we'll catch you next time. Alrighty, I've got Brian on the line. Brian, how you doing today?
Doing well. How are you, sir?
Doing all right. We appreciate you you coming on and chatting with us about some property.
Yeah. It's hard not to like and talk about property.
That's exactly right. You know, kind of hit the heartstrings and what everyone's passionate about when you talk about land, and specifically this piece, because, you know, it's pretty special to you. And if you will, real quick before we jump into the details of the property, talk a little bit about yourself, and then kind of what you got going on here today.
Yeah. You know, I'm a Missouri boy, and you know, kind of grew up in a middle class family, and you know, always just grew up around hunting and fishing, and just, you know, that's what we did. You know, anytime we had a free moment, we were hunting and fishing something. You know, we weren't really prejudiced. We always like to do it all, any chance we got. But long story short is that, you know, land has always been a real attraction for me. You know, just because never, you know, my grandpa owned some row crop ground, but as a whole, we just didn't always, you know, never had any hunting property of our own, always hunted public land. And, mm-hmm. and to be honest with you, I still love hunting public land, partially from the competition, you know, so to speak, but also just because we're pretty blessed, you know, in Missouri where I'm at. You know, we've got quite a bit of really good hunting, you know, good quality public land to hunt, you know, for most things, even for deer, at least prior to the Orange Army coming out during gun season, you know, yeah. it's we've got many places to go. So, but, you know, always have that, you know, always had that thought and that idea of, you know, it'd be awesome just to love, you know, to actually own some property, have some of your own ground and, you know, just still yet. I mean, I've always been, I still consider myself to be, definitely in a middle classer, you know, doing whatever I can to make a dime and make a buck where I can, but, mm-hmm. but also always having that admiration or just that desire to have property. And so, you know, about 13 years ago, we bought our first piece of property, my wife and I did, mm-hmm. Which we still have today, which is one that we probably won't ever sell. We call it, it's called Landon's Duck Pit. It's just kind of a special place. It's kind of near where my wife grew up, and mm-hmm. I developed it into a wetland, awesome. You know, but then, you know, about 5 years ago, we bought another piece of property, which was close to our home where we're at in Wayne County, just on the eastern edge of the Ozarks. And we bought 60 acres, just a, you know, small parcel there. And the whole intention there was to buy it as an investment, right. You know, with the standpoint of, you know, because I grew up, you know, my dad had a construction company, and growing up, we'd build houses, and every few years we'd sell that house and, you know, build another one. And the mm-hmm. whole purpose behind that was to essentially get mom and dad out of paying a mortgage payment, sure. and, you know, down the line, and, you know, we could always build up just a little nicer home each time. And so I kind of had that same concept and philosophy and thinking about land, mm-hmm. you know, using kind of spinning off what my dad did with homes. And I know there's many folks that have done that, either just buying and selling or, you know, building and selling, whatever the case might be. It's kind of a smart move for many folks, which, you know, land is another major, major investment, you know, only second to a house mortgage or a
absolutely.
Home. But so I kind of had that same concept. And so we bought 60 acres, you know, made some improvements, sold it. And then you know, now I've kind of reinvested in a different piece of property. We did that about 3 years ago. It'll be 133 acres down in Carter County. Okay. And so that's kind of what I think you wanted to talk a little bit about. I don't know how much further you want me to talk about it, or just let you ask some questions.
I'm really interested in that property, just because of some of the success that you guys have had and your family has shared on that property. So you guys obtained it 3 years ago. Talk to me about kind of what you guys have done management wise and implemented on the property to kind of get to where it's at today.
Yeah, you know, it was one of those to where it was kind of the right piece for me. Mm-hmm. Like I said, it was 133 acres, and having a biology degree and a biology background and wildlife management, you know, it just, you know, I kind of got that, I wouldn't say that skill set, but that desire. Yeah. So whenever we bought this, it was the perfect. It was had highway frontage, electric mm-hmm. was right there. You know, had many, many aspects that most folks like to see that you don't always get in a hunting piece of property.
Very true.
You know, but at the same time, it was just a narrow piece that came out to the highway, and the main part of it was 120 acres that set off the road. But again, it was just a blank slate. It was a piece of property that had probably been cut over, you know, just looking at it. It was, you know, I would say it was cut over pretty hard, probably 50, 60, maybe 70 years ago.
Okay.
And so it was a lot of, you know, there were some mature trees on it. In the overstory, but there was a lot of, you know, a lot of trees in the understory. Mm-hmm. And it was just one of those perfect pieces for me in looking at that was like, it's a blank slate.
Yeah.
And it was something that I can pick up, I can run with, and, you know, just, you know, and of course there's all sorts of ways of evaluating and we all have different thoughts and opinions on what we're looking for. But for me, it was perfect because it was, you know, being that blank slate, I could walk in there, evaluate the timber, do what I needed to there. But then also I could mold it and make it to what I wanted. And being flat, it also had lots of options for food plots. You sure. know, in fact, you know, I had a dozer and an excavator in there for a week and a half. And the excavator operator, he was like, oh, Brian, which he's a cattle guy. And, you know, he was like, I wish I owned this place. But I'd be clearing every tree off of it just because it's kind of one of those yeah. that, you know, a cattleman would like. It's nice, easy rolling, mm-hmm. you know, if, you know, where there is a roll, but overall it's, you know, just pretty flat ground, which is kind of hard to find in the Ozarks as a whole, especially along the current river,
yeah.
you know, up and down the current river valley. So,
no
you know,
question.
But long story short is that, you know, it was a real, real nice piece. And we went in, you know, one of the very first things that I did, you know, after doing a quick evaluation was like, you know what, true to most places across the Ozark, you know, the red oaks were about 60, you know, 60 to 70 mm-hmm. years old. The mature ones were, they were on decline
yep.
Because they're pretty much maxed out in age.
Yep.
So I went in and I wasn't necessarily looking at making money off the timber.
Mm-hmm.
What I was looking at was actually, you know, number one, it was an improvement because they're going to die within probably 5 to 10 years. Everything was going to be dead. So I was looking at it as let's take them out now.
Where there's still some value, you know, associated with them.
Exactly. Yep. While there's still some value, but also it was going to do a thinning for me. You
mm-hmm.
know, it was something that needed to be done that I didn't have to do. It was less chainsaw work for me.
That's exactly
so,
right.
So went ahead and, you know, we had a thinning done. We used some of the money that we made because we didn't make a bunch, not like a normal timber sale would
sure.
be on 133 acres, but I knew it wasn't going to be.
Right.
You know,
that wasn't the goal. That wasn't the intent.
It wasn't the goal. No, yeah. Honestly, it was actually to improve the forest health.
Sure.
And essentially, what we only harvested were the red oaks. I
mm-hmm.
mean, there were there's only a handful of white oaks that I marked for cutting, but that
mm-hmm.
was just because in those white oak stands where I had a bunch of 14 to 16 inch white oaks that were kind of competing with each other,
mm-hmm.
I'd go ahead and mark one or two of them.
Absolutely.
You know, just to help release what was left.
It was a large scale TSI project.
Exactly. It was a commercial thinning TSI, essentially.
Right.
And, you know, which I've done, you know, since that time, I've done quite a bit more TSI work, you know, and roughly about half the property.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is by design, too. I don't want to, I'm one of those guys to where I may have an idea or a thought that I need to do this over the entire property, but when and where I can, I like to do it in piecemeal, partially because it's easier to bite off. But as you and I know, excuse me, as habitat managers, you know, we want to create as much edge as we can when
okay.
and where we can, you know, for the hunting, for huntability of the property.
And
so I kind of look at many of those projects when I'm doing prescribed burning and my TSI work that I implemented on the property. I kind of wanted to align it as much as possible with my deer movement patterns,
sure.
you know, thinking about predominant winds and things like that. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, so, and that was the same thing, you know, I utilized that because we developed a road system through the property, you know, just in that road system is to allow, you know, ease of access based upon the wind directions, you know, whether you're hunting the timber or the food plots, because they're,
yeah.
you know, we do have five openings on the property, you know, they're, you know, there's a couple of smallest ones are, you know, about quarter acre in size. You know, one of the smallest ones probably about a quarter acre, a little under, not quite a half acre in size.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of them are, you know, are larger than that. And, you know, just because being in the Ozarks, you know, it's kind of once you develop a food plot or a place for a deer to eat, once they figure it out, they hone in on it traditionally. So, you know, which is kind of a neat process too, because also got some, I actually have some topsoil there.
Yeah.
Which is kind of can be a hard thing to find. And so we've done everything we can too to help preserve that and promote that,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether it's the microbes in the soil, you know, promote them, but, you know, using no-till,
sure.
you know, where we can just to make sure that we do it right. So
that's exactly right. Long-term kind of planning and forecasting for the longevity of the property That
yes.
seems like a lot of forethought is put into, you know, what you've been doing work-wise in the timber and then in the wildlife openings there as well. That's awesome to hear. In the couple years of management and hunting, what kind of success have you guys seen from a hunting aspect on the place?
We've seen really good success. There were deer there anyway. It's kind of in a part of the world where it's pretty big country as a whole.
Yep.
And so there is hunting pressure around, but it's not, doesn't have the hunters per square mile that you see in some other locations of Missouri,
right.
And in other parts, but, honestly, deer numbers were pretty decent. We've killed, in 3 years, we've killed 8 deer off the property,
okay.
133 acres. That's, me, my dad, my brother, and my son. And I've got a niece and a nephew that have also killed deer off the property.
Awesome.
So, it's kind of been a family affair. It's been one of those things to where, to be honest with you, my dad, it's a little bit of a sore subject, just because my dad absolutely loves the property, because mm-hmm. having hunted a lot of places in Missouri and even a lot of parts of the country, Wisconsin, Kentucky, and just various places around the country, he's like, Brian, I love this place. And, mm-hmm. And I've told him from day one what the intent was, but
sure.
It's kind of it's a little bittersweet, but at the same time, we just also realize there's memories to be made of other places. So, and part of the enjoyment for me is as much developing the property as it is hunting it. If somebody else has success, I think that's just as much fun. But we've had really good success. Actually, we killed a couple turkeys off the property.
Mm-hmm.
I've not hunted it super hard for turkeys. I mean, it does have a turkey population and a decent turkey population.
Sure.
But I didn't want to overhunt it. Because I wanted to develop it more, especially for brood habitat and brood rearing in some locations, and making sure that we didn't pressure or push too much on the turkeys. Normally I'd have, 4 to 5 gobblers on the property,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't want to overhunt or overshoot the property, if
yeah.
that makes sense.
Oh yeah. What kind of projects have you done for the brood rearing and nesting habitat for turkeys?
A lot of that is through TS, after the timber harvest, mm-hmm. Of the red oaks, there were some pockets that were thinner,
yeah.
that were to where it was heavy on the red oak. So there'll be some places that were real thin in hardwoods. So what I did was I kind of stayed to that tradition and managed for the post oak and the white oak that was
yeah.
there, but also made it more of a woodland setting.
Mm-hmm.
Came in and, managing for that real early successional habitat. And which is a key component. Then also, of
oh,
course,
yeah.
Got a couple, two of my smaller food plots. I do have clover in, so that's
mm-hmm.
Really good for bugging in as well. Really good bug food clover is. So those little baby poults can get out there. But also right beside it, again, I've got early successional habitat, and even some thicker stuff in a couple pockets to where if a hawk or an owl or bobcat or something tries to interfere with the daily bugging episode, then they can have cover
quickly
pretty close
get
too.
To cover. Yeah,
exactly. So, kind of having all that, into one,
mm-hmm.
but it is, it's just kind of neat. For me, I would say as much as anything, as I was kind of saying earlier, some of the memories,
mm-hmm.
One of the, I don't know. I'm kind of I like to ramble sometimes, so I don't know how much time we got.
Well, you're
but,
good.
One of the neatest things to me was probably one of the most frustrating moments in the beginning that I ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually, I've kind of got it, this is, the property's not officially on the market, but it is up for grabs. And,
sure.
and I kind of put it out there on my Facebook page that, hey, if anybody wants it, they can contact me. But in one of the photos, the one that's getting that got the most likes and, people just loved was one of my daughter. And I better not say the seed company that she was pulling beans out of, because it's technically Stratton's competitor. But long story short was I was riding a tractor. It was mm-hmm. one Friday evening right before a rainstorm, picked the kids up from school and daycare. And we ran out to the farm. And I was on the tractor drilling beans, and I looked over, and my daughter had she was all the way up to her shoulders, practically head first in this bag of beans. And I would see her, and she was pulling out of this $80 bag of forage beans and just slinging them.
Oh,
and of course I was 200 yards away, and I come and I immediately jumped off, you know, stopped and jumped off the tractor. And when I was hot because, you know, I mean,
that's some,
you know,
money.
You know, $80 bag of beans is, you know, kind of, you know, that hits pocketbook a little bit.
Yeah.
But the closer I got to it and the more she swung, you know, I could see just the grin on her face.
Right.
And I'm glad I was 200 yards away from her because, you know,
there's a little bit of cool down period.
Yeah, because as I got about 50 or 60 yards, you know, I could see the grin on her face. And when I got about 30 yards, I said, her name is Rayleigh. I said, Rayleigh, what are you doing? And she said, Dad, I'm feeding the animals, you know, as a typical 3-year-old.
Yeah.
And, you know, and as soon as she said that, my heart just melted, you know, because it's like one of those things to where I didn't care. I let her sling that entire bag, the rest of that bag out, because at that point in time, it didn't matter to me.
Yeah.
It could have been $200
right,
a bag, and it would have been worth it just because it was so.
She's
you
just
know,
taking
I mean,
part
are,
of what the family was doing. She wanted to help.
Exactly.
Out.
Exactly. You know, and so there's different things you do on a property like that to where you make a memory, but you know, the neat thing, at least for my mind, is, you know, when I'm thinking about it as an investment, you know, it's difficult sometimes to kind of separate, you know, because my long-term goal is to have the property as, you know, to be able to buy a property outright to where I don't have to go and pay a mortgage. And that's what my, my long-term goal is. But in order to do that, I can't get caught up in some of the emotional things either, some of those memories. But I also know that it doesn't matter because we'll just make the same or not the same memories, but new memories somewhere else.
Right.
So, you know, that's kind of why I'm looking to kind of reinvest is, you know, another piece, hopefully so that down the road I can actually own a piece outright as opposed to having to go to the bank every time.
That's exactly right. There you go. Yep. And that's neat. That's what investing in properties can do though, is, you know, make your money kind of work for you if you know what you're doing. You've got a plan to develop it, but you're also enjoying that investment. It's not like you can go and enjoy a stock on Wall Street or whatever. You know, you can actually go out to this property with your family and make memories as that property is developing and hopefully going to have a good return for you in the long run.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and even if I'd keep the property, I know that, you know, because, well, I always think about this, you know, because the property right now, even what I'm, you know, I'm looking at, you know, $1,275 an acre, which for that neighborhood up and down the Kern River, and it's in Carter County, Missouri, and, you know, you go to land, you know, different land websites and look at prices, you know, it's pretty easy to find a lot of that ground that's $1,700-$1,800 an acre.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah.
You know, so long story short is that I know that, you know, I'm well under the market, but for what I have in it, I don't have to worry about that.
Sure.
And,
sure.
You know, but, you know, that being said, you know, I know that I've also got, even if I held on to it, there's something there for me, you know, down the road.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I try to keep my plan too, which I think that's a key component of doing that.
No doubt.
Is need to stick with your plan. You know, once you get a plan, you need to try to stick with it.
No question there. Mentioned a couple of things there that we haven't talked about yet. Kern River,
yep.
Close to that. How close is it to the Elk area? Because
it'll be on the east side of the river from the Elk. It's about Ellington area. There's elk venture on that side of the river quite a bit. So if you look at that, especially the bulls in the summer months and early fall, it seems like they spend quite a bit of time there in the Ellington area. It's roughly about, you know, just, you know, the way a crow would fly or an elk would walk across country, it's about 15 miles.
Okay.
You know, so it's not right there in the neighborhood, but it's not overly far from that either. But it's depending on how you go, it's about 7 miles from the little town of Van Buren, which a lot of folks know in that part of the world because it's a float town and, you know, just a real tourist town, neat little place. But, you know, there's a county road that you can shoot across Highway 60 on that you can be on the Kern River, you know, at a primitive access, gravel bar access. And, you know, you could be there in about 7-8 minutes from the property.
That's
so, I
perfect.
Mean, it's got, you know, so, I mean, it's kind of one of those that's not on the river, which has advantages and disadvantages, you know, but it is, you know, but it is right there close.
Well, great. I mean, that sounds like a perfect kind of all-season recreational property. Great hunting fall and spring for various wild game, but then you have the opportunity to still enjoy it on the weekends in the summer and go and float. Like I said, that's a humongous float town. Current River is one of the most scenic rivers in Missouri. Spring-fed, crystal-clear water, just gorgeous. And I think it's a great recreational area itself. If you like the outdoors, I know there's lots of hiking trails and stuff around even outside this property. So sounds like a fantastic opportunity for someone. So you said 133 acres, looking for $1,275 per acre. How do they get in touch with you, Brian?
Probably the best way to get in touch with me is just by my cell phone. It's 573-714-1109. And I'm, you know, even if it's about my property or any other property, I'm happy. You know, I do, you know, I dabble in real estate as well. So, you know, I'm willing to help out kind of like you guys, you know, anytime with anyone. And, you know, but, or even just, you know, if they just, they don't have to be interested in the property. Just want to talk about, hey, what I've done. Yeah. You know, if they got questions about that, I'm, you know, as you know, I like to talk, so you know I'm not afraid to visit on the phone.
Not afraid to answer the phone call. Well, good deal.
Yes.
Best of luck in selling. I'm looking forward to staying in contact and kind of seeing. Hopefully, it moves quick for you. And who actually, you know, ends up taking ownership of it? Because, you know, like you said, this is a plan, an investment, but there's still a part of you that, and I think with any property, honestly, there's part of each landowner that kind of remains with the property. Everyone kind of leaves their mark, and that's why, you know, land and legacy, that's kind of the origin of the name. So it will be neat to see Brian, who kind of takes up after what you've done, appreciates it, and hopefully continues to kind of carry that torch with the property, improving things for, you know, the land, for the wildlife, for the soil, for the water, all that. It's super important. So interested to follow along.
Oh, yeah. Well, and anybody that would purchase it, you know, that is one thing that kind of get me with the property too, because I'd like to have an update on occasion because, you know, I do, because you do feel a connection with the property, you know, as you say, but also it becomes a relationship even with the person, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if they have, you know, it's just kind of neat. You know, I want to know what kind of memories they make and things that I might have done wrong. However, I can also tell you that this property is just kind of getting to where in the next couple of years it's going to be really, really, really good.
Mm-hmm. Well, fantastic. Yeah. Appreciate your time today, Brian. Appreciate you coming on, and looking forward to seeing the future of this place.
Sounds like a winner. Thank you, sir.
Take care.